Hey, Chris Garlock here with this week's Labor History Today.
I'll tell you what I was thinking about when we wrote it. I was thinking about the Wobblies.
That's director Julia Reichert. Her call at the Oscars earlier this year for Workers of the World to Unite went viral. She and Stephen Bognar won for their film American Factory, and we've got the second part of her interview with 9to5 founder Karen Nussbaum.
The Pullman strike was a solidarity strike. They were striking in sympathy with the Pullman workers. And that idea of people pulling together, I think you're seeing now.
That's Jack Kelly, author of The Edge of Anarchy, The Railroad Barons, The Gilded Age, and The Greatest Labor Uprising in America. At the peak of the Gilded Age, a conflict in one of America's largest factories exploded into the most extensive and threatening labor uprising in American history. The Edge of Anarchy tells the dramatic story of this historic event. Jack Kelly's book transports the reader from the fabulous white city of the 1893 World's Fair to the nation's industrial heartland, where unprecedented hard times are brewing rage across the continent. In the summer of 1894, more than 500,000 desperate railroad workers went on strike. Riots broke out in Chicago and other major cities. The nation's commerce ground to a halt. Famine threatened isolated towns. The U.S. Attorney General declared the country to be on the ragged edge of anarchy. Here's our interview with Jack Kelly. Hey, up next, your favorite part of the show coming up here, Ed. We're going to do our labor history segment. And our guest, he's a guy I've been trying to get on for, it feels like, months now. He's author of another one of my books with a great subtitle. This has been the year of great books with great subtitles. Jack Kelly, his book is The Edge of Anarchy, The Railroad Barons, The Gilded Age, and The Greatest Labor Uprising in America. Jack Kelly, thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be with you, Chris.
So a lot of folks are not going to know of this particular struggle that you're writing about. So can you sort of give folks a little background?
Yeah, the origin of the Pullman strike began in 1893 when there was one of the worst depressions. In fact, the worst depression was referred to as the Great Depression up until that time. And it was a typical bank and Wall Street panic and then led to enormous unemployment and lasted for about 5 years during the 1890s. And in the second year of that depression, one of the largest factories in America, it was just outside of Chicago, the Pullman Works, and they produced rail cars. They were famous for their sleeping cars. And George Pullman, who ran that company, had a system of company town in which he kind of recycled wages, where they'd pay the wages, but then the workers had to pay him back to live in these rented houses and apartments that they had in the company town. And during the Depression, as their wages were lowered and their hours were lowered, they still had to pay the same rents. He had started with pretty exorbitant rents to begin with. So the guys would work 2 weeks and they'd get a check for $2 because they had paid their rent. They got fed up with this. They went on strike. They had become members of the first industrial union in America, which was the American Railway Union, started by Eugene Debs. And it was a union that included everyone in the railroad industry. And the Pullman workers were members of that. Most of the members of the union worked on the railroads themselves. They were on the trainmen or worked in the yards. The Pullman workers asked the other members in solidarity and out of sympathy with them to stop handling Pullman cars. And they did so. And that created a national crisis because it essentially shut down the railroads. And the railroads wouldn't budge. They wouldn't take the cars off that were Pullman cars. So they simply fired the workers. America then learned how dependent they were on the railroads because it was many cities that was the only way to get to them. There was no road system. So in the middle of the Depression, you had this enormous crisis of a labor crisis, and really it involved tens of thousands of workers.
So there's a couple of things there that we want to get into. One is this story, and I got to say, this is a wonderful book. You've written it essentially like a novel. I mean, it's really novelistic, and I just love that. My father is a labor historian. I've been reading labor history for years, and I love it. But I mean, honestly, a lot of time it reads like history. You've taken, and I knew about this strike, but the granularity and the drama and. Maybe I'm totally misreading it, but my reading of your book, it's really this showdown between George Pullman and Gene Debs. And so just give thumbnails, because I think folks may or may not know about Debs, but Pullman is just an amazing character.
Well, yeah, I think you're right, Chris, that the personalities and the people involved is really the way to bring out the drama in a story like this. And it was the very colorful personalities. George Pullman had essentially, he was not an inventor, but he was a master businessman, and he knew how to manipulate capital at a time when a lot of even very sophisticated businessmen didn't understand Wall Street. But he knew how to go to Wall Street, how to get huge amounts of capital to finance his business, and he became extremely successful. Eugene Debs had been a fairly conservative labor leader in the railroad industry, and the unions in the railroad industry at the time were what they called brotherhoods, a craft union, so that the engineers had a union, the firemen had a union, the brakemen had a union. Debs thought they're being divided, which they were, and defeated, and if a fireman could run a train as well as an engineer. So if the engineers went on strike, they would just turn to the firemen and say, "Well, now you run the train." He said, "We need one big union." And it was an idea that was very much ahead of its time. It didn't really come in successfully until the 1930s, and United Auto Workers is a good example, where everybody in an auto plant, no matter what the job is that they do, they're all members of the union, the UAW. So Debs was wary of going on strike during a depression, but he got the idea, and a lot of people did, that this was going to be the big confrontation, that the workers and capital were finally going to fight it out to the end and see who was going to win. And he became very enthusiastic for the strike. It was a difficult time. The workers really did win the strike. The railroads were up against the wall. Many of them were shut down. They were heavily leveraged, so they had to meet these debt obligations, and they would have had to make a deal. But the fly in the ointment really was the government, because at that point the government stepped in and broke the strike.
We're talking with Jack Kelly. He's the author of The Edge of Anarchy, The Railroad Barons, The Gilded Age, and The Greatest Labor Uprising in America. Ed Smith, my co-host, wants to get in on this.
Mr. Kelly, thank you very much. Yeah. I always love when Chris books authors that talk about labor history. And so we're talking about 126 years ago or so. And exploitation, I think, is probably still around. I think we can probably all agree.
Good call, Ed. Good call.
So I think about the Wall Street bailouts, and now with coronavirus, the bailouts for a lot of corporations. In your view, is this just a more sophisticated way of exploitation, or is it the same old? And the other thing that I find very interesting is the company town. These business owners were very smart about that, but they were also borrowing on history, going back for years and years, going back to even feudalism. So maybe if you can comment on both that.
Yeah, I would say that they were pretty sophisticated, and I think that was where somebody like Pullman really stood out from, and people like John D. Rockefeller. They understood and they knew how to work the levers, and particularly the levers of government. And so the parallels to me are that you see today, Grover Cleveland, who was the president at the time, had an attorney general named Richard Olney. He was a railroad lawyer. He was a director of several railroads while he was attorney general. He didn't see any reason to recuse himself. So
I did not know that, by the way. This is the amazing part of the story, by the way, Jack. I was not aware of that. And you read this and your jaw just sort of drops. And it's like, how did this happen?
Yeah, it's essentially when it came to Olney, rather than act as the chief law enforcement officer of the country, he essentially just went to the railroad and said, what do you want me to do? And he did it. And that was, they wanted two things. One was an injunction, which he got a court injunction that just simply flatly said this strike is illegal. And he got federal troops to be sent in, which was very controversial. Not militia, not National Guard, but federal troops were sent in to break the strike. So today, we're looking, you look around, you see, they have the head of the EPA is a coal lobbyist. The head of the Interior Department is a oil lobbyist. There's no pretense of the government as the referee. That here's a dispute, the workers versus capital. We're going to be the referee. We're going to try to sort it out. We're going to maybe even arbitrate. They went totally onto one side in the dispute, and that was the reason the strike was defeated.
There were two other points that I thought were really fascinating in trying to break the strike. One was one had to do with the mail, and the other had to do with how Pullman. I mean, just like the unions were not all necessarily together, and I mean, they're two sort of parallel stories. I mean, you know, Debs and the American Railroad Union trying to organize the labor movement, which was definitely not all on board, and that's one story. And then, but it was interesting, the bosses were not all agreed either, and even Cleveland, from your telling, was not. I mean, he left it up to Olney, but Pullman, from your book, kind of bullied the other railroad owners, right?
Well, the railroad owners saw they were afraid of the American Railway Union. They were afraid of the unity of the workers. They liked the brotherhoods because the brotherhoods they could play against each other. So when they saw the strike coming, they and Pullman got together and they told him, we've got your back and don't give an inch because we want them to go on strike. And they saw that as a way of breaking the union, and they were correct. So, and to mention, to go over a couple of things you mentioned, the mail was the reason they gave. There was two reasons they gave for why could Grover Cleveland send in federal troops. One was to keep the mail going, and the other was that several of the railroads had been nationalized, essentially, because they'd gone bankrupt. And the federal government had taken over the running of them. So that if you struck against one of those railroads, you were striking against the government. The government had the authority to send in federal troops. Those were very flimsy pretenses for doing it, but those were the reasons it gave.
So I have an epilogue question. You might want to tell the audience whatever happened to Eugene Debs after this strike and subsequent.
Well, that was that wasn't the central focus of the book, but I have to say I was writing this book during the 2016 election, and it was a great morale booster to spend time with Eugene Debs, who's a tremendous, inspiring character, and his career as we know it really began with the Pullman strike. He went to jail for. The strike having been made illegal, and he continued to promote the strike, he was sent to jail for 6 months. He came out of jail, and he was on his way to becoming a socialist. And he really founded the American Socialist Party. He founded the ideas of democratic socialism that we're seeing at least a small revival of today. And actually, when you consider Bernie Sanders, who's Debs was a great hero of Sanders, a pretty significant revival of democratic socialist ideas. These go back to Debs, not to so much to Karl Marx, but to Debs had this optimistic kind of American view of socialism. He felt that if the government was going to come in on the side of capital, the struggle of labor had to be a political struggle, and we had to change the government. So he ran for president five times as on a socialist ticket. And he lost every time, but he built a movement. He went around the country. People loved to hear him speak. Very sympathetic speaker and orator, and he spread a lot of the ideas of socialism that were very radical, as Bernie Sanders says. You know, hey, this idea was radical until I started talking about it. Now it's accepted. But you know, Social Security or minimum wage or unemployment insurance, these were considered really out fringe ideas. But Debs kept pushing them and pushing them, and eventually they worked their way into the mainstream of politics. So he was certainly a fascinating character, and I think somebody that deserves a little bit wider publicity now, you know, somebody that can turn to and look at. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is really the descendant of Eugene Debs.
We're talking with Jack Kelly. He's the author of The Edge of Anarchy, The Railroad Banners, The Gilded Age, and The Greatest Labor Uprising in America. It's a terrific read. I just couldn't put it down. Went through it in about 3 days, and I've been recommending it to everybody, Jack. Again, it's not just labor history. It really is just this very dramatic. I mean, it's almost a script. I feel like you could just make a movie out of it. Let me ask you, and Ed got at this a bit, and I just want to sort of bring it back as we head into the end of the interview here, but they can call it what they want, but whether they call it a recession or a depression, I mean, we're in this huge economic contraction at the moment, certainly something that, you know, to the extent that we haven't seen in our lifetimes, but you've got a historic perspective. I mean, that period of time you're talking about, they had depressions every 5 years or so, as I recall. So I'm just curious, with that perspective, how we can look at what we're going through right now from where you sit.
Yeah, I think that the what I took from the research I did about it was the idea of solidarity. My father was in the United Auto Workers for decades, and we used to get the union newspaper, and the title was Solidarity. And it's a word that's fairly common, you commonly run into, and the labor movement is not used very widely in the general society. But I think the Pullman strike was a solidarity strike. It was a sympathy strike. It wasn't the railroad workers were looking after their own interests. They were striking in sympathy with the Pullman workers. And that idea of people pulling together, I think you're seeing now. We saw it at 9/11. Oh, all of a sudden, police and firemen and paramedics, they're heroes. Look, they run toward danger. That lasted for about 6 months. Then they weren't heroes anymore. They were people asking for a raise or a pension that people didn't want to pay for. We're seeing the same thing today, the solidarity with medical workers, with nurses and doctors and paramedics, and we're all in this together. But how long is it going to last when they come and say, you know, we want a living wage, we want a... People in supermarkets, you know, there's a sense of solidarity. Those are human beings that are risking their lives, actually, by going to work. All these things come back to the idea of solidarity, which was one of the big themes of Eugene Debs' life and one of the messages, I think, that he passed on to us.
Jack Kelly, author of the new book, The Edge of Anarchy: The Railroad Barons, The Gilded Age, and The Greatest Labor Uprising in America. Here's the conclusion of 9to5 founder Karen Nussbaum's interview with Julia Reichert, who won an Oscar earlier this year for her film American Factory. Reichert has been making documentary films for 50 years and is known as a godmother of the American independent film movement. They start out talking about the classic labor film Union Maids and the strong connections of that film, made nearly 50 years ago, to Reichert's most recent film, 9to5, The Story of a Movement, co-directed with Stephen Bognar, who also co-directed American Factory. The interview ends with the wonderful backstory of Julia's call at the Academy Awards this year for Workers of the World to Unite. Here's Karen Nussbaum.
So let me ask you about union maids.
Yeah.
Why did you decide that people needed to hear about organizing, or that women organizing in the 30s? Why was that important to you then?
Well, let's see. So that was shot in 74 and came out in 76. Mm-hmm. Just so you know, the actual three interviews were shot in 74. Uh-huh. But then with editing and doing activist work and filmmaking not being our main thing, actually, came out in 76. Uh-huh. I think it has to do, I'll go personal and larger. Personal, it has to do with me having become aware of what the meaning of the word class is when I was in college. Uh-huh. Like in the later part of college, you know, we all started studying Marx and Engels and Che Guevara and all those people. And so I started realizing that class wasn't something to be embarrassed about or mm-hmm. or pretend your parents did something much more important than they really did, like lie about yourself, which I had done for years, in order to get into that educated world of college people, that class was something that was a motivating force in history, right? Mm-hmm. And it was important. Yeah. And so working class people became important in an intellectual way to me, not just that I felt connected, but in an intellectual way. Even though I was from a working class background, I didn't know working class history. I didn't know anything about women we were all discovering that women were agents in history too, but that had been 100% written out, right? Yeah. We had no clue who were the important leaders. I wanted to get to know my progenitors. Uh-huh. And I wanted other working class women, but on the political, on the larger side, historical context wise, the movement was, so I was a New American Movement, uh-huh. and which is a socialist feminist organization that had some power and strength at that point. Our part of the movement was beginning to be focused on get a job in a union, uh-huh. get a regular people job, you know, talk about being a leftist. It's okay. You know, talk about socialist feminism, socialism, what are those ideas? You know, we could do that. I mean, it disappeared for a long time, and now with Bernie, we can start talking about it again. Mm-hmm. It's been a long gap there. We wanted a tool for the movement as we knew it. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally, we wanted a tool for the movement as we knew it to bridge the gap between the union movement and the women's movement. It's mm-hmm. it's a similar impulse to 9 to 5, to be honest.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
So we knew our colleagues in NAM were getting regular people jobs and union jobs and, you know, fighting in a more mainstream way. You know, we never became one of those vanguard parties. We all went through those discussions.
Yeah.
Right? And we decided, no, that was not going to work. That wasn't us. That wasn't me. Uh-huh. That wasn't my partners. We were learning about unions and the importance of organizing working class people. And how do you do it? You don't do it through a vanguard party. That is not going to work, we felt. That seemed silly, actually, to me, because I know you know about that.
So is that why you had so much of a focus on the tactics, which I loved? That's what spoke to me about the film, was
about union maids.
The wonderful detail of the tactics that they used in organizing the women in their workplaces.
Well, yeah, because we wanted our people to pick up on that.
Yeah.
But also, they were incredible storytellers. Honestly, I don't think we were, like with 9 to 5, I was very aware of focusing on tactics, right? Because now I understand more what it means to build a movement and that you need tactics, you need strategy, you can fail, you can succeed. But back then, I think it was honestly a little more, if we got tactics and strategy, we lucked out, because I think it was more, these are great storytellers.
Yeah.
Let's sit at their feet and get their stories. You know, like literally we read the Staunton Lynn book, the Allison Staunton Lynn book.
Yeah.
And our friend in NAM, Miles Mogulescu, had made like a very crude little videotape. He was in Chicago. He had gone to the University of Chicago. And he had sat them down and just did a little interview with each of them. And we saw it. He showed it to us on the back porch of somebody's house here in Dayton. And we were like, wow, these are good women. These are good stories. But it was so crude, you know, And it was, you know, it was just a little videotape. So we said we should really do it right, you know, do the interviews with two cameras and really do two or three hours a person. But honestly, we did no research. I didn't read a single book other than the Staunton and Alice Lynn book. And we sat down with them. We literally met them, set up the cameras, and shot. I mean, it wasn't like with you guys where we read everything we could find and previous interviews. And you know what I mean? It wasn't like that. Luckily, these were three incredible storytellers. But then we did the research. Here's the thing. We did the research afterwards. That's why it took 2 years. Like, once we got that, I felt like I'm a research nut now, you know. Anyway, not to go into this too much, but the photographs that we started finding of that period, like in labor history, I finally got some labor history books and started reading them and saw the pictures of that period, the 30s, with women with baseball bats in their hands and National Guard with guns. And I'm like, what the hell happened? You know? So then that led to researching at the National Archive and the Library of Congress and finding all that film footage and learning about labor history, like on my own, kind of reading books and going to all these places and putting it in a film. I wish I could say, wow, you know, we thought about, we had to include all the strategy, but honestly, we that's not true. I think we just thought it was great stories, and we did want to make it useful to the movement, but I think they did that naturally. I don't want to take too much credit for that, really.
No, I hear you. And and it is the combination of these fantastic stories and the unbelievable footage that you captured. And it's what makes the film just zip by. It's a very compelling visually.
And nobody had seen that footage. It wasn't like it was in a lot of other films. And the National Archive staff and the Library of Congress staff were like, they saw us come, you know, for weeks, you know, with that film. With Seeing Red, it was years, because that really has amazing footage. We wanted to make it entertaining, and we wanted to make it come alive. And just the interviews wouldn't quite do that. I mean, that's where the filmmaker comes in.
Yeah.
Right. When we did test screenings, when we sprinkled in a little bit of archival moving footage, not just stills, people in their seats, you could see it, would like sit forward. So you kind of knew as a filmmaker that you needed more of this to make this lively. But I will say, we never thought of it as a film for film festivals or television. We thought of it as a tool for the movement, just like Growing Up Female, with different purpose, which was put in the hands of fellow sort of democratic socialists, women's movement, labor movement, and see if we could bring them together, right? Bring the women's movement into seeing the progenitors who are working class and powerful, and bring the labor movement to say, like, honor women and put women into leadership.
And what made these films so powerful that they become award-winning?
I think we inherently have a sense of storytelling. Good story, archival footage, untold story. I think that's a really big one. I don't know what to say. It's a good movie. It's lively. It's an untold story. It has great characters. It has all the things a good movie should have, even though it's black and white.
You know, maybe that you're making a film that was an important story for you, and then that comes out in the quality of the film in some way. But,
well, you know, they all are, though, Karen. Every single one of them I would not make unless it were important to me personally.
Yes.
And I didn't know that I realized that at the time, but looking back, 100,000%, they're all come out of some need or urge or question. You know, like Seeing Red, you know, comes out of how are we going to sustain a movement through hard times?
Right.
You know, and again, this question, are these people for real? That was a very big question in Seeing Red. Mm-hmm. Are these people actually fighters for the right, or were they traitors and spies? I mean, honestly, we didn't really know when we started. The only person we knew, as I recall, who had been a member of the Communist Party was Dorothy Healy. And we could see she was totally for real.
Yeah.
You know, even though she's a little imperious and clearly a leader type, you know.
Yeah.
But we could tell that she, on a gut level, really cared about people. She has natural leadership abilities, but it's like you have some incredible natural leader abilities. At the same time, we know you care about people.
Getting back to the good storytellers, of course, one of the hallmarks of your films are the unbelievable interviews that you get done. You've already said that the three women in Union Maids took care of that themselves, more or less.
Yeah.
But then you have these, sometimes with unbelievable challenges, like in Last Truck, you conduct interviews through a car window as people are driving out of the parking lot, or, you know, with Chinese workers with whom you don't speak the same, you know, have this huge cultural chasm.
Yeah, right.
So how do you do that? How do you overcome those kinds of obstacles? And why is that so important to you?
Of course, because I want the audience. There's things about the audience, but I'm thinking it goes back to, I am just, for some reason, very curious about what makes people tick.
Mm-hmm.
Why do I get such good interviews? It's because I invest the time. Like, we don't just interview people once.
Mm-hmm.
Those interviews in American Factory, for example, or The Last Truck, where we developed those relationships over months. And we showed, you know, we would stop in at people's house, or we would bring, like to Lion, we would bring people a cup of coffee in the morning and just sit down and talk.
Yeah.
Time, investment in time. And people realize you actually care about them. You know what I'm talking about. You know, it goes beyond that you have a function. You're a filmmaker. You want to capture a story. It's like you care about them.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't care about everybody, being honest. You know, there are certain people you care more about, but you still try to be representative. So you put in a lot of time, and you repeatedly interview people. We interviewed the chairman 7 or 8 times,
mm-hmm.
and like pretty much almost every time he got to the U.S. Something one of our producers was just looking over, I'm just going to give you this as a side, was just yesterday he was saying he had looked over a lot of the long interviews we did with the chairman, because he was looking for something he was writing about. And he said he was amazed at how much in the transcripts was not talking about the factory at all, was talking about his children and how his family reacted to him coming to America, and how he deals with American food, and what keeps him up at night, and, you know, just all this other stuff that just shows an interest in him.
Yeah.
As opposed to, we also ask the tough questions. Well, how are you dealing with the union? Why are you opposed to it? What about unions and, you know, all that kind of stuff? Economically, how are you dealing with the lack of profit and, you know, all those kind of questions? But it was always based on, like, how are you doing, you know, and how's it going? And this is how it's going for us. And, you know, so I think it's all about, like, the fact that we live in the area where we make our films in general, you know, not seeing red and not even Union Maids, although, again, that was like, you sit down and talk for 2 hours and say bye. But with even seeing red, we always saw people numbers of times and sat down and did, we either stayed with them or nearby. You know, it was product of a relationship. And definitely with Truck, and definitely with Factory, those are all people we spent a lot of time with. They're not just figures of, like, here's a globalization person, this is how it's affecting them. It's like, no, it's Bobby, it's Jill, you know, it's people.
Julia, there's a theme in your films of no regrets. Is this a theme in your work? Does that resonate with you?
It does. Boy, but I hope I haven't imposed my own life story on other people's life stories on the films. Because I feel that. I feel that 1,000%. Like, it's like Bill Bailey says, you know, don't let them walk over you. You know, cough or something. Let them know you're here. You know, all these people saying, like in Seeing Red, like, no, I don't regret the life I've led. And the same with Katie and Union Maids.
Yes.
No, my family may, you know. I feel that way, too. I feel that way 100%. Like, I'm glad I wasn't on the sidelines. And I'm glad I'm still not on the sidelines. I found a way to be not on the sidelines of history, of people of, you know, and I have a strong identity with people in the labor movement and in the women's movement. I feel like I swim in that same current. And we've taken our knocks, for sure. We continue to. No regrets. When I go to my grave, I don't want to look back with a sense of, wow, I should have done this or I should have done that. And I don't have that feeling. I'm thinking over those three women and union maids and all the people I knew in Seeing Red. What is that one woman said? I feel like part of the mainstream of life. When I show union maids and The Last Truck together, It's very hard. People are really aware that the labor movement was this feisty, broiling over thing, and that you know that people were drawn into it, and people fought, and yes, it was hard, but they look at all they won, and we all can say that, you know, we won the weekend, we won the end of child labor, we won Social Security, blah, blah, all that stuff. But then we were so disheartened by the workers. There was no sense of fight back. There was no sense of, we got to organize. There was no sense of, I don't care what the union says, we got to speak up. There was no sense of, like, anything. It was a sense of being discouraged, beaten down. Gee, I guess we just got to accept it.
What was the most gratifying aspect of working on 9 to 5, and how did your view of the project change over the many years that it's taken to finalize?
I love the approach of 9 to 5, that it was about empowering women. Mm-hmm. That it was, and you saw that with almost every interview you did, these clever ideas that were, as Adair puts it, like organic, right? I love that line. That line was never going to go out of the film, you know? Uh-huh. Like, we have to think about our community and build our movement organically. I think 9 to 5 did a wonderful job, and it's a great example to the women's movement, any movement, right? Mm-hmm. Build it, look at your community, look at their needs, and build it from there with, you know, smart leadership with maybe bigger goals in mind. But so build the movement organically, empower women, not just organize women, you know, not just like get them to vote for something, which of course is organizing and is educating, but really in a much bigger sense, taking this community of people who were, you all recognized that women call themselves as second-class citizens then. You also understood that you had to organize for women's power. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just a matter, to me, of getting everyone to vote for the union. You had to have leaders who were women who were empowered. And a lot of them rose to the occasion, had leaders that cared about them, that cared about them as women, that understood the struggles of women. Like when Carol Sims says, she joins the picket line, and then she says, I got interested in change, and I became an organizer. And there's a lot more to that story, but that's the basic thing, you know.
I have one last question, and it's an easy one. How did it feel to say, workers of the world unite?
Oh, that was great.
It's of 24 million people.
Well, I got to say, it was great. It felt wonderful. It felt scary. Steve and I, we knew we had to do that. The question was how to include it. It had to be 45 seconds, the entire thing, with thank yous and everything. So I got the mic first, and which was planned. And, you know, I talked about how workers in China, workers in America, workers are having it tough. But things will get better when workers of the world unite. I mean, it just sort of flows, right?
Yeah.
But it's actually quoting Karl Marx in the Communist Manifesto, which I wasn't thinking about. You know what? I forgot. I was thinking, I'll tell you what I was thinking about when we wrote it. I was thinking about the Wobblies. I think of it as an old, like, radical labor movement slogan. But then people immediately started saying, I'm quoting the Communist Manifesto. Steve and I had rehearsed a number of times, sitting, and we got there early, and we sat in our seats, and we're surrounded by other documentarians, and we're all hugging, and because we all got to know each other. We rehearsed the whole, how far does he have to step out to allow room for me with this huge-ass dress on? And we practiced walking up, and I had to clutch both parts of the dress because I had a crinoline. It was like a prom dress. And I had to practice like not tripping over the dress. Honestly, I had two things in mind. Don't trip on the dress and get to that mic, and in a most calm, passionate, organic, sincere, just get those words out. Get those like 20 seconds or whatever it was of words out, and do it in a way that just feels like I'm just the nicest person and I'm saying something that's so logical.
Well, so that's what it was. It was a huge hit. Julia, thank you so much. This has been fantastic. It's just a wonderful interview, and I can't thank you enough.
Well, thank you. And thanks for this. Was great. This was fun. Thanks for listening.
Director Julia Riker talking with 9to5 founder Karen Nussbaum. Part one is in last week's podcast, and you can also read a version of the interview at prospect.org. That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app, and we hope you do. And also, please pass it along. We appreciate it. And if you'd like to contribute by reading a labor history item, just shoot us a note at laborhistorytoday@gmail.com. Today's music was, of course, the Internationale in honor of International Workers' Day last Friday. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Chloe Daniel, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Jessica Pozek, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Scarlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history. And we'll see you next time.